Good evening. I ask if you would go ahead and open your Bibles to 2 Thessalonians chapter 3. 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, and a lot of this is going to be familiar to you. It's strange that Paul writes to the church in Thessalonica twice about this topic, the topic of honest labor. Dr. Adrian Rogers wrote, "Whenever somebody receives something without working for it, somebody else has to work for it without receiving it. The worst thing that can happen in a nation is for half of the people to get the idea they don't have to work because someone else will work for them, and the other half get the idea that it does no good to work because they don't get to enjoy the fruits of their labor. As dangerous as that is in a culture, an economy, and a nation, the becoming disenfranchised in the body, the Henny Penny syndrome, you might say, that Henny Penny desired to bake some bread, and so she went out to do the things that were required in order to bake bread, and along the way invites others to be involved in it, and they want nothing to do with it. They want nothing to do with the work, they only want to do with the reward. And so when she receives the bread at the end, she has so many friends, so many individuals who would love to share the bread with her. And occasionally, that becomes an issue in the brotherhood. It becomes an issue in the world easily. The term lazy Christian is an oxymoron. That is to say, two words that by definition are mutually exclusive. You cannot have a lazy Christian. They do not exist. Now, a Christian, can find opportunity to rest, can make an honest wage, they can do all kinds of things. But a Christian, a child of God, a worker in the kingdom, cannot be lazy. It'd be like saying an honest liar. They don't exist. And I could make a lot of jokes about politicians, but I won't. Here in 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, I want you to notice with me as he begins here in verse 6, he says, "But we command you, brethren, in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you withdraw from every brother who walks disorderly and not according to the tradition which he received from us. For you yourselves know how you ought to follow us, for we were not disorderly among you." He says, we have already established the example when we were with you. Early on in Paul's ministry, he was in Thessalonica, and he had spent a good deal of time there through the years. And here in 2 Thessalonians, he's already written them once, as was mentioned before in 1 Thessalonians 4, concerning disorderly brethren, concerning individuals who refuse to work, who would not do their share as part of the gospel of Jesus Christ, not only in the ministry, but they wouldn't even secularly work. They wouldn't work for the bread that they wished to receive. They were a blight upon the congregation, individuals who took and did not provide at all. Not that they were unable to, but that they refused to. And here in verse 8 he says, "Nor did we eat anyone's bread free of charge, but worked with labor and toil night and day, that we might not be a burden to any of you. Not because we do not have authority, but to make ourselves an example of how you should follow us." Notice here, he says, not because we do not have authority, verse 9. In 1 Timothy chapter 5, verses 17 through 18, talking specifically about elders in that circumstance, he draws from an illustration. He tells Timothy that when it comes to the eldership in particular, or anyone in the ministry, he says that it is inappropriate to muzzle the ox as it treads out the grain. He is speaking from an understood proverb, that when the oxen is treading out the grain, it is inappropriate for you to muzzle it so it can't eat along the way. It is inefficient for you to do that, because the oxen is entirely capable and is worthy of eating as he works. He is the one that's treading out the grain. You don't want the ox to eat while he treads out the grain, then you tread out the grain, is the concept of the proverb that Paul is utilizing here. And he is talking in particular again about an eldership, that it is appropriate if an elder is in a position to work in a particular capacity in the ministry, to do a lot of good for the community, for the church at large, for them to receive pay, which is a wild idea to us in today's world, but was a pretty common idea back in the first century and moving forward. But we've gotten away from ideas like that. But in the interim here, notice he says back in 2 Thessalonians 3, not because we do not have authority to ask it. Not that it is not appropriate for me to decide that it would be better if I didn't work and I went ahead and got support from you all. But it was prudent. Paul had determined that it was not expedient to the gospel in this situation to receive support from this congregation. But in other locations, it was better for the gospel that he not work secularly and rather dedicate himself to the ministry, because that time that he had spent tent making was not the most efficient use of that time and that energy that he had. The most efficient use of time and energy would be for him to work in the ministry, very much like the apostles in Acts chapter 6. They didn't deal with the Grecian widows, even though it was a very important thing to deal with. They decided that it was not appropriate for them to leave the work of the ministry in order to serve tables. Not that it wasn't important, not that it was demeaning by any means. Jesus had set the example of what we should do, what we should be willing to accomplish when he washed his disciples' feet. But that it was not expedient in the situation for that to be done. And so we have this situation where God values honest laborers. God is happy with individuals who will work diligently. And Paul, in this situation, he wants to set the example in a community that would rail upon him, that would be upset about the situation of him not working for his wages, not working for not that Paul wouldn't be working in the ministry, but that they wouldn't perceive it in the same way. And so it would be a detriment to the gospel as it would go out. And he didn't want to be a detriment to the gospel. And so he decided that it would be more prudent for him to work, be a tent maker as he was in previous situations from time to time. But he made that decision as he came to it. He came to that decision situationally. Hard work, uncommon, the popular belief, is not a four-letter word. And when I say that, I mean a word that is disreputable or a disreputable thing. In this culture, anything one can do to avoid work is oftentimes praised. And I see people, they are sharing all kinds of ideas about how to work the system and game things that go on. We have had similar situations here, and though I will share a couple of instances, I do not mean to discourage people from participating in and donating to the food pantry that goes on here. Many, many individuals are helped in severe circumstances through the food pantry, and I get to see that and experience that. And if any of you wanted to be involved in it, I would be happy for you to be a part. A few of you are, and I appreciate all the work that you do, and I know the community appreciates it. But we have changed our policy a few times. And the most recent policy change was to limit, not overall the number of times you could come, but after three times, you sit down with me and we go through a financial counseling course. And isn't it weird that when we instituted that, the number of people who needed help so severely declined significantly? That we get calls now from people, and it's maddening, and they are desperate for food. They don't have anything in their pantry, anything in their fridge, and so we set up an appointment for them to come in and receive food, and they don't show up, and they don't call. They have found a way to game the system. I've even heard of congregations who talk amongst themselves, amongst each other, I should say, of individuals who will go from the congregations that support or have food pantries, and people will basically get all of the food they need from those food pantries. And I can't be involved in running down every lead, every trace, figuring out who's gaming the system and who's not. You'd be amazed at the number of people who want to tell me who's taking advantage of the church. And I don't have any dealings with that. We establish the policy, and then for the most part, as far as I can tell, the policy works. There was a woman who literally lived right across the street. And she did not work a secular job. She claimed that she wasn't able to, and that could very well be true. I don't know. But I know she had plenty of time on her hands. She never attended services. She never came in, and yet when we reached the fourth time that she came in for food, we sat down with a financial counseling course, and we went through it, and that was fine, and she got three more times. And then the seventh time came up, and she came back to me, and I told her, along with some other things, some changes that need to be made. That's what the financial counseling course is for. Some things that need to be changed, some things that need to be moved, or maybe some decisions that need to be made that they're not making. In this circumstance, she had a two or three storage units that she was paying more than $150 to keep the storage units. And I am thinking, why are you keeping these storage units? Well, they have things in them that are precious to me, that are important to me, okay? Move them into your house and stop paying the storage fees. Well, I'm not going to do that. Okay, then we're not going to be able to help you. And she was so convinced, because the world's understanding of religion and Christianity is that you will just roll over the first sign of hostility. She was sure I would cave. Well, I didn't. And she had come in a couple of times since then and asked if the policy had changed or if she would be able to get food. And I asked her, one time it was fortuitous, there was someone receiving help from the food pantry at the time. And I had just explained the rules and how the situation works. And she comes in the door and asks, she says, can I get food? And I said, have you gotten rid of your storage units? And she said, no. And I said, then no. And those people looked at me very oddly because they didn't anticipate that I would stick to my guns, that we as a congregation would make a decision and we would hold to that decision. Because the churches at large in the community, the denominational world, because they don't hold to the doctrines or the teachings, so why would they hold to anything, really, in truth? They want to be pleasers of men. They want to make people happy because that will get people in the door, and we are less concerned about getting people in that door and more concerned about getting people in the door of Christ, the true door. And so when we talk about work, this culture does not understand work. This culture does not understand hard work and what it means to labor. There's a general misconception in the world that either work is a bad thing or that work is a product of sin, and that's simply not the case. If you go all the way back to Genesis chapter 2, in verse 15, when God created man, he placed them in the Garden of Eden, and he gave them a job. That's well before, who knows how many days, but that's well before Genesis 3, where sin enters the world. And yet God intended on Adam to till the garden, to take care of it. So the first profession is not one most people think. It is, in fact, gardener. And God gave him that job in Exodus chapter 20. Oftentimes forgotten, though, the Ten Commandments, so severe and so important to so many. And it was important at the time. It's not something that we are bound by today, but it does give a principle. In Exodus chapter 20 and verse 8, remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. 6 days you shall work and do all of your work, he says. You shall labor and do all of your work. Now we get that backwards. See, we want to rest 6 days and work one. That's the ideal, is it not? I mean, that's what people would really love. And they love the Sabbath, and sometimes they keep it multiple times a week. And I don't mean that in a religious way. I mean, they want to rest all the time, consistently, and yet that was not God's design. That was never God's design. It was never God's design to encourage laziness in either the community and never in the congregation. And so when we find situations where an individual needs help, we should be there to help them, especially in the household of faith. But where an individual refuses to help themselves, to help make sure that their job or that they have what they need, if they refuse to work, the New Testament tells us that they should not eat, that there are consequences to making bad decisions, consequences to being lazy. People like to remember the Sabbath, but there is a time to relax after the work is done. Remember where the Sabbath falls in the week, at the end, not at the beginning. And it's not the whole week either. In Proverbs 6, go ahead and go with me there. We're going to be in Proverbs for a little while, which makes sense, I suppose. In Proverbs chapter 6, something you're probably fairly familiar with, but do not get his comments concerning the ant mixed up with Aesop's fables. They're totally different. The ant, the grasshopper, not in the Bible. Sorry. So here in chapter 6, notice in verse 6, he says, "Go to the ant, you sluggard. Consider her ways and be wise." Why? Why go to the ant? He says, "Which having no captain, overseer, or ruler, provides her supplies in the summer and gathers her food in the harvest. How long will you slumber, O sluggard? When will you rise from your sleep?" Now, I think Aesop got an idea about his parable straight from the Bible, perhaps. He says, that's pretty good, I think. I'm going to write a story about two personified creatures. Let's make them like humans. The ant provides her supplies in the summer, which implies that once those supplies are received and stored, then the ant rests ultimately in the winter. There's nothing else to do. And so they appreciate and enjoy the fruits of their labor. You can't enjoy the summer until the work is done. You can't enjoy the fruits of your labor until the labor is accomplished. Notice in verse 10, he says, a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep. So shall your poverty come on you like a prowler. Now, don't get the wrong idea here. He's not saying a little slumber is a bad thing. Notice the compounding of the situation. He's a little slumber, a little sleep, a little folding of the hand. That's a lot of rest. That's not a little rest. That's not, I'm taking the Sabbath in the Old Testament. That is, I continually rest and I don't do anything else. He says, and your need like an armed man, or so shall your poverty come on you like a prowler, and your need like an armed man. And that really is the problem. Because laziness is contagious. And that seems to be an issue in the New Testament. If you go back to verse 14, if anyone does not obey our word in this epistle, note that person. And do not keep company with him, that he may be ashamed. And the context here is a person who refuses to work, who refuses to do that which would be beneficial not only to his life, but to the life of those around him. He is a continual leech. Not that he is unable to work, but that he is unwilling. And that is unacceptable. And it is uncommon in the world today to think about, it is unconscionable to allow a person to be hungry even if they refuse to work, and yet the Bible tells us to let them be hungry. And that's a hard thing to do. It is hard as a parent to let your child fall down and hurt themselves, even though you know exactly what's going to happen. And you make judgments as far as how dangerous it is. Certainly, you wouldn't let your child fall down off of a two-story window. But if they're just running through the parking lot, or they're doing something dumb, and it's not going to hurt them too terribly bad, you let them scrape their knee. It's the only way they're going to learn. And yet, oftentimes, in the effort to be generous, we enable ungodly behavior both within and without. And brethren, it should not be. Now, there's a limit to what we are capable of finding out in the community, of discovering about a person and their willingness to work or not. But once we do our due diligence, then we can help people. Then we're able to do what we are capable of helping with. In Proverbs 1, the Proverbs writer warns his son. It would be essentially David to Solomon, and Solomon really should have listened better, and then Solomon should have passed this on to his son, in truth. Notice in verse 10 he says, my son, if sinners entice you, do not consent. If they say, come with us, let us lie in wait to shed blood, let us lurk secretly for the innocent without cause, let us swallow them alive like Sheol and whole like those who go down to the pit. We shall find all kinds of precious possessions. We shall fill our houses with spoil cast in your lot among us. Let us all have one purse, my son. Do not walk in the way of them. Keep your foot from their path, for their feet run to evil, and they make haste to shed blood. Surely in vain the net is spread in the sight of the bird. But they lie in wait for their own blood. They lurk secretly for their own lives. David realized not only robbers, but ultimately people who are willing to do criminal activity, people who are lazy, they do it because they're lazy, because they don't want to put an honest day's labor in to receive an honest wage. And so they find alternative ways in order to procure what they want. In Proverbs 19 and verse 15, a lazy person will go hungry because laziness induces deep sleep. Remember, a little slumber, a little sleep, a little folding of the hands, it just keeps going. I'm just going to take a nap for a little while, and a nap would be fine. But it continues, and the laziness continues, and the laziness continues, and it becomes a detriment both to them and to the people around them. We need rather to, as the New Testament tells us, for 2 Thessalonians 3, in verse 9, he says, not because we do not have authority, but to make ourselves an example of how you should follow us. For even when we were with you, we commanded you this, if anyone will not work, neither shall he eat. Isn't that interesting? He commanded them. That word is the same that you would use from an officer to a subordinate. An individual in the military would demand, command, would instruct his followers, the individuals that are beneath him, to do something, and it was intended that they do it, and they continue to do it. And this individual, these individuals that he's talking explicitly to, if anyone will not work, neither shall he eat, that seems harsh, and yet it is for the betterment of the individual, it is for the betterment of the congregation, because there are no lazy Christians. There may be lazy individuals in the congregation, there may be lazy individuals outside of the congregation, but there are no lazy Christians. It's an oxymoron. Such a thing cannot exist. He says, "For we hear that there are some who walk among you in a disorderly manner, not working at all, but are busybodies." What happens when an individual is allowed to not work? They'll find other things to be involved in. Put people to work, and it will keep their hands out of evil. Now those who are rich are such, we command and exhort through the Lord Jesus Christ that they work in quietness and eat their own bread. But as for you, so he has an answer for them. He says, if you're getting this letter and you're reading these words and you're a lazy person, quit being lazy. Get to work in quietness. Eat your own bread. Stop taking advantage of the congregation and their generosity. Now, in a situation where if you're unable to work, that's an entirely different situation. And Paul would encourage, just as he does in so many circumstances, not only of widows, but of orphans, of individuals who are incapable of taking care of themselves, of providing for their own, you help them, period. It's a manifestation of our love, 1 John chapter 3, of our faith, James chapter 2, to take care of those who have need. And it is absolutely biblical for us to, but it is not biblical for us to take care of people who are capable of working and refuse. And to the rest, he says, "And as for you, brethren," verse 13, "do not grow weary in doing good." Remember our quote. Sometimes the other half doesn't feel like they're getting any reward from it at all. And in the church, it can be difficult to remember this. In the world, it's exceedingly hard to remember because you don't have much perspective in the eternity. But when we put forth effort to be a part of the congregation and to support it financially or with our work and our labor, it's difficult sometimes for us to relegate that the money is God's. It's no longer ours. And the temptation is to consider it ours even though it's in the collection plate and even though it's being used for the glory of God, potentially, and for us to hold on to it metaphorically, to think that we have some sway over the congregation or the things that are going on in relation to it. In verse 14, he says, "And if anyone does not obey our word in this epistle, note that person and do not keep company with him that he may be ashamed." This is the same concept that Paul deals with in 1 Corinthians chapter 5. With the man living in adultery with his father's wife, you say, how serious is Paul about laziness, about people who are taking advantage of the church? This is how significant this problem is. He relegates it to the same punishment. That you would put them out of the body, that you would not have company with them, that you would not be that way, that they may be ashamed, that they may realize the error of their way and they would change, because that's ultimately what we want. Not for them to be merely ashamed, but that they would be ashamed to the degree that they'd be sorry that they did it and they would change, because that's what we want. In verse 15, he says, "Yet do not count him as an enemy, but admonish him as a brother." He's not an enemy simply because he's misguided. That individual just needs time, just needs an opportunity, but he needs to be challenged. See, we like to sweep things under the rug and pretend things don't happen or didn't happen. You can't do that. And there is a temptation not only in our culture, but even in the church today, for us to just be okay with whatever sin enters the camp, to just overlook it or bypass it and pretend it doesn't exist, and that is unacceptable. It is unacceptable for us to do so. It is unacceptable primarily because the sanctity of the church and the example that those individuals set matter. And it's going to spread and it's going to cause disease and corruption in the rest of the congregation. Evil company corrupts good habits. But additionally, it's not beneficial to the individual. Because if that individual is doing something ungodly, is doing something unspiritual, then they are going to suffer the consequences for that. And you don't love them if you don't let them know. If their house is on fire, you would let them know. How much more so if their soul is on the way to hell? We've got to let them know. We can't let them continue thinking that they are on the right pathway. We need to consider them a brother and do what is best for them. There is a natural recourse for their laziness, and that punishment is hunger. An individual without, an individual within. If they refuse to work, they will not eat. We cannot stand in the way of the natural process that God has created and told us to utilize. We can't, for the spirit of generosity and the desire to make people happy, do that which God has told us not to do, or encourage people by allowing them to do so. We have to encourage godliness, and it's hard. It is hard to do. It is hard to make those rough decisions. I feel for that lady who would like to keep all of those possessions, but they are not significant. They are merely possessions, and they need to be gotten rid of, or she's going to continue paying that money on those products, and she's going to continue lacking perspective in those situations. And so you have to stand tall. You have to stand with a hard countenance, and you have to be willing to make those hard decisions. It's not easy. The third point he makes here is possibly the most important, though this previous point received the most attention in time. This last point, I think, is the most important, and that is that our excellence of work should be an example to others. Paul said, "I worked so that you would receive the example of how things should be done, so that you would realize not only you, but the people around you. I wanted my example to be the best it could possibly be." And that's the decision that Paul made in every circumstance. The best example I can give you in this circumstance is for me to work, right? The best example I can give in this circumstance is for me to accept the benefit of the congregation, the support of the congregation, and put forth the full effort in the ministry. Whatever the situation was, that's what he did. He says, "In whatever you do, do heartily as to the Lord and not to men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the reward of the inheritance, for you serve the Lord Christ." Colossians chapter 3, verse 23. We've got to remember that we are not working for our boss, right? That when you go to work in your secular job, that you are not working for your boss. Now, you know, that complicates things when you think about the paycheck and where it comes from. When we work as if we are working for the Lord. That changes everything. It changes our entire perspective. It changes where our authority comes from. It changes how we do the things we do. This is actually an issue many preachers face. They fall into difficulties in it. How do I make the congregation like me? How do I make the congregation happy? And that is the wrong question. The question is, how do I please God? Hopefully those two things are congruent. But if they're not, I know what choice should be made. And all of you do. We all understand the choice that should be made. We should not be man-pleasers, but rather we should please God. And so there are times where I have to make decisions because it is a godly decision, even if it is not good for perhaps the appearance. Perhaps it is not good for the profession. I don't care. I can't care because I work for God. And I have to make the godly decision rather than what is always the best decision for my career or whatever the case might be. We have to be able to do that in every situation, in every capacity, whatever we're doing. Even if we are retired and working for ourselves, we have to be able and willing to make the call that God is the one in charge. The best way to demonstrate a godly character in your work is to remember you are working for Jesus. A long, long time ago, I had friends that worked at Chrysler, and I don't know if it's still the case now, but I know at the Chrysler plant they worked, they had a lot of difficulties relegating this situation with God being their boss, because there was a system set up at the time where once you reached a certain number, there was a quota that you had to reach. And once you reached that quota, you were encouraged by the union and by your fellow coworkers to protect your job by not working anymore. And so oftentimes, if you worked diligently, you could get the quota met in 2 or 3 hours, and you had an 8-hour day. And you were continually paid for the rest of those 6 or 5 or 4 hours. But because of the union, the way the union worked, they were able to work out a system where individuals were encouraged not to work. Were encouraged to sit and play cards. They had to stay on the premises. But they were encouraged then by the union, by their fellow workers, and there was nothing legitimately the company could do to stop them. to encourage them to work, to make them work during those hours, so they would oftentimes either draw it out as long as they could, or they would get it done as soon as possible and then go mess around with their friends. And I had a couple of friends who worked at that place, and they got into a lot of heated arguments with their coworkers, a lot of issues with the union, because they did not work for the union, they did not work for the boss, Chrysler. They worked for God, and they could not, in good conscience, do less than their best effort at their job, to give a reasonable time, a reasonable work ethic to the job that they've been called for. They couldn't sit in the break room and play cards while they're getting paid, when there were things that needed to be done or could be done. And it didn't make them very popular. It didn't make them very liked. They got into a lot of trouble, and a lot of complaints were levied against them, some honest and some incredibly dishonest. But they didn't care. And it was the right decision for them, because they worked for God. They worked for God before they worked for anyone else. Who are you working for? Oftentimes, we work for ourselves. Even if we work at a secular job, we work for ourselves. We work so that we have money to do the things that we want to do. And we're only willing to do the things that we're willing to do, and we're not willing to do anything more than that. But work goes so far beyond simply the secular work that any one of you is involved in. Work is entailing of all aspects of life. What about service to God? What about in the things that you can be involved in the body of Christ, and how you can be involved in good and prospering ways to the body of Christ here in this location, or maybe around the world? What can you do? Because you are a worker in the kingdom. There are no lazy Christians. So if you are a Christian, then you are a worker in the kingdom. Then there is a plow for you to pull. Then there are things for you to be doing. And if we get in the mindset that work is a four-letter word, now I know it is, but you know what I mean, then we have got the wrong mentality. We've got the wrong mindset. God intended for us to be involved, to work to begin with. But he intended on us to work for him more particularly and most importantly. So regardless of where you work or what you do, are you working for the Lord? Are you an example to the people around you in your work ethic and your determination and your dedication? Regardless of whatever it is, if you're the ditch digger, be the best ditch digger you can be. Whatever you do, in word or deed, do all in the name of Christ. And you will be a great example to the one to whom you belong. And you will help others to come to a better understanding of his expectations on them and of his love for everyone in this world. If we can be a help to you through this time to become a child of God, to begin working for the kingdom of Christ and be saved according to the will of God, we would love to do that tonight, help you in that way. If you need to come back to him because you've not been a worker in the kingdom, you have become the oxymoron of a lazy Christian, which is to say a fallen Christian. You have walked away from your covenant relationship with him, and you've refused to be involved in the working of the ministry, of the opportunities that you can be. You can change that. You can change, even if you can't always change how people perceive you, you can change who you are. And you can make the changes today. And if we can help you, if we can help you to get yourself right with God or become right with God once again or to stay right with God, whatever you need, I pray that you would come as together we stand and sing.